On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Huck Finn's pap was never an angel. In Mark Twain's famous telling, he had a bad drinking problem and a cross of nails in the heel of his boot. Locked Huck in a Mississippi River cabin and beat him hard, so hard that Huck took off. Now, novelist John Clinch has picked up Twain's Huckleberry Finn and imagined the rest of Finn Sr.'s story. It reads more like a David Lynch film, dark, violent, scary, and ultimately illuminating. This is another side of America's life on the Mississippi. Up next on Point, author John Clinch on his hair-raising twist on Twain, Finn. Joining me now from Philadelphia is John Clinch. His first published novel is Finn. The Washington Post calls it spellbinding, disturbing, and darkly compelling, says the Hartford Courant. From USA Today, the cantankerous Twain would welcome the company. John Clinch, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Pretty cheeky to write a takeoff on. Pretty cheeky to write a takeoff on Mark Twain. Where do you get the nerve?
Well, it is. You know, as you pointed out, my background with this story goes all the way back to when I was 10 or 12 years old, reading it completely unsupervised, completely without a chaperone. And my experience thus is that really, of so many of us, I started with this book as a child, and it changed for me over the years. A lot of people said it would be a bad idea to try to follow Twain's lead and write this book because they thought I'd be compared to Mark Twain and found wanting. They thought that it was probably a poor idea to muck about with one of America's greatest literary icons, Huckleberry Finn himself. But I think it was more a matter of honor and humility than a matter of nerve.
Honor?
I really set out to do what I consider an honorable job of pursuing the threads that Mark Twain left either unfinished or unsatisfactorily resolved in Huck Finn, and also to honor his particular personal obsessions in life. I mean, Mark Twain was a very dark, depressed individual and grew only more dark and more depressed as his life went on. And I think in some measure, this story is as much a reflection of my understanding of Twain's character as it is of my understanding, if I can put it this way, of Twain's characters.
Ron Charles wrote in the Washington Post, and we quoted a little bit from him there, praising your work, but he says that while working on Huckleberry Finn, Mark Twain, or Sam Clemens, wrote in his journal, "I can't say they cut his head off or stabbed him, etc., described the blood and the agony in his face as if the readers just wouldn't take that." And a decade later, when with the depression that you described, writing or telling a friend that he couldn't write all the things he wanted to, that would require, he said, a pen warmed up in hell. Are you that pen, John Clinch?
Ron Charles was kind enough to suggest that I might have located that pen somewhere, and that did my heart good, I'll tell you. Frankly, I think I would desire to pick up that pen. I would desire to show the Mississippi that Mark Twain gave us as modified by the Mississippi that Mark Twain wanted to give us in those novels. But he couldn't because of his audience and because of his time.
You know, like you and maybe everybody else under the sun, of course, I read these books, Tom Sawyer and then Huck Finn, and this was kind of the turf of my youth, not far from the Mississippi and playing around in Hannibal.
Oh, really?
And all the rest. And I vividly remember when I first ran into Huck's father, this was a kind of darkness that as a child I hadn't come across before in Mark Twain. Maybe nowhere. The drunken brutality, the violence, the, you know, beating up Huck and all the rest. I remember reading it with fascination, but also kind of racing through to try and find that sunny Mark Twain again. I mean, isn't that what some part of us really wants, that sunny, youthful idyll along the Mississippi?
You're right. And a lot of us think it's in Huck Finn, and it's not really in Huck Finn as much or as deeply as we'd like to believe it is. It's probably in the Disney movie, but it's not really in Huck Finn, which is a deeply surreal book. But God bless you for having had the experience that I had upon reading this book the first time and meeting Pap Finn, as so many of us did, and being exposed by his presence in that book for the first time in my life, apparently for the first time in yours too, with alcoholism and child abuse and virulent racism. I mean, these were things I didn't get at home.
Said, what's going on here? Where's Mark Twain taking me? You start right off with a passage from Twain. We want to get to your work, but maybe the best way to begin is to have you read this little bit from Twain, set it up for us and read it. So right in the front piece of your book, From the Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, could you set up and read that little bit of Mark Twain? Remind us of your kind of starting point in what you make a nonlinear tale.
A lot of folks kind of ignore prefaces and epigraphs to books. I advise them not to ignore this one. It's from Chapter 9 of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And Huck Finn narrates, "He went and bent down and looked." Now, we've got to remember they're in a floating house. They're in a floating house on the Mississippi River.
That is Huck and Jim, the runaway slave.
Second story window, yeah. Huck and Jim. "And he went and bent down, and he looked, and he says, 'It's a dead man. Yes, indeedy. Naked, too. He's been shot in the back. I reckon he's been dead 2 or 3 days. Come in, Huck, but don't look at his face. It's too gashly.' I didn't look at him at all. Jim throwed some old rags over him, but he needn't done it. I didn't want to see him. There was heaps of old greasy cards scattered around over the floor and old whiskey bottles and a couple of masks made out of black cloth. And all over the walls was the ignorantest kind of words and pictures made with charcoal. There was 2 old dirty calico dresses and a sunbonnet and some women's clothes and underclothes hanging against the wall and some men's clothing, too. We put the lot into the canoe. It might come good. There was a boy's old speckled straw hat on the floor. I took that, too. And there was a bottle that had had milk in it, and it had a rag stopper for a baby to suck. We would have took the bottle, but it was broke. There was a seedy old chest and an old hair trunk with the hinges broke." Now, this scene goes on from here, and there are a number of other peculiar objects in this room where we find Pap Finn dead. There's a wooden leg. There's a dog collar. The list goes on and on and on. There are, of course, whiskey bottles because... Right. Pap Finn was one of our world-class drunks.
Right.
But the other things...
Yes, please.
Are strange. The other things are strange.
Well, strange, the masks made out of black cloth and the ignorance...
Well, what does that indicate, huh?
What strikes me rereading this, it sort of as the warm-up to where you take us, John Clinch, is that Mark Twain was no stranger to the real down and dirty. I mean, you feel the seedy... dark kind of undone side of human life laid out right here very fluidly and familiarly by Mark.
Yeah, and imagine coming in the window with Jim and Huck, or before the house was afloat in the river, coming up the stairs and seeing this room whose walls have been defaced with charcoal, these things of the ignorantest kind of words and pictures. I mean, that's a scene straight out of, you mentioned David Lynch earlier in your introduction, which cheered me. Not only that, but any kind of contemporary horror movie. I mean, it's a scene from Seven or The Silence of the Lambs. There's something very deeply strange here.
Speed us right forward then to the start of your book a page later, just to get a feeling for how John Clinch follows on. Take us straight to it, if you would.
Chapter 1 begins under a low sun, pursued by fish and mounted by crows and veiled in a loud, languid swarm of bluebottle flies. The body comes down the river like a deadfall, stripped clean. It proceeds, as do all things moving down the Mississippi in the late summer of the year, at a stately pace, as if its blind eyes were busy taking in the blue sky piled dreamily deep with cloud. There'll be thunder by supper time and rain to last the whole night long. But just now the early day is brilliant and entirely without flaw. How long the body has been floating would be a mystery if any individual had yet taken note of its passage and mused so upon it. But thus far, under that sky of blue and white and upon this gentle, muddy bed aswarm with a school of sunfish and 1 or 2 smallmouth bass darting warily as thieves, it has passed only empty fields and stands of willow and thick, brushy embankments uninhabited. A crow screams and flaps off, bearing an eye as brown and deep as the Mississippi herself. Sunday morning, early, and the river is without traffic. An alligator gar, 8 feet if it's an inch, rises death-like from the bottom and fastens its long jaw upon a hip bone, which snaps like rotten wood and comes away. The body entire goes under a time or two, bobbing and turning, the eggs of blowflies scattering into the water like thrown rice.
John Clinch, reading from the very beginning of his new book, Finn, and we are in strange territory right away. Within pages, we are led to understand this is not his father. This is Huck Finn's mother, and there's a lot of news that comes with that. The body floating in the river, and we've got cannibalism and brutality and everything right on down the road coming right in behind it. Did you ever fear you went over the line with the blood and guts and darkness of this?
Part of my reason for writing this book had to do with... to steal a line from a Warren Zevon album titled "Learning to Flinch," I'm interested in the power of literature to teach us how to flinch and how to cringe all over again when we see things that we've actually seen a million times before, the kind of things that we see on television and in the movies, and in sort of the cheapest kind of thrillers that don't affect us too much. But I was interested in taking a very, very serious look at this kind of thing.
Mm. Let's go to Warren in Hampton, Virginia. Warren, you're on the air with John Clinch.
Yes. Hi, John.
Hi, Warren.
I just recently picked up a copy of the original Huckleberry Finn at a book sale, and just about finished it, and I was amazed at what it brought now, as opposed to after watching the Disney version and all of that over the years, how explicit it was and how... reading the dialect of it is difficult. It takes you a while to get through it because you're reading it in dialect and all the bigotry and other things that are in there. I was amazed. I'm very interested in seeing where you take it from there.
So it wasn't the book you remembered, Warren?
Not at all. It was
good for you. That means we all grow up and we see this book differently, don't we?
Absolutely. I'm interested in how young people today would take the original and your book, as a sequel, and how they would deal with the racism and stuff if they were reading that now.
I've had an opportunity to spend some time with some high school teachers and some high school students who have spent some time with both Huck Finn and with Finn, which is always an interesting exercise, I think. One thing that they discover is that in Finn, the narrator never uses the N-word, but the characters do. And that kind of gives them a little bit of insight into the prevalence and the omnipresence of the N-word in Huckleberry Finn. So it kind of explains that to them, which is good. The other issue that has come up a couple of times so far is that people who've read Huckleberry Finn and then move on to read Finn sometimes find themselves thinking, oh, now this is the real story. And I take that as a compliment, and also as a reflection of the fact that these two books are very different.
Mm. John Clinch, I don't know how to properly talk about this without laying out what you make pretty clear within just the first few pages of your book. For anyone who's reading closely, you throw a couple
of cat's out of the bag.
Cat's out of the bag.
So you can go.
So, well, I mean, you make, and this is central to your book, Finn. You make Huck Finn's mother, Pap's common law wife, you might say, before mm-hmm. she's dead in the river, you make her black, which
yes.
means Huck Finn's mom is black. Huck Finn is half black, light skinned, whatever you want to call it. But race is not just in the air, it's in the family. It's in Huck Finn's immediate family here. Describe how you paint the picture of that family and why you paint it that way.
The why is really of interest to me, and actually I kind of triangulated the answer to that question, the solution that Mary, Huck's mother, is a black woman, from three different points of view. One was Finn himself is the vilest sort of a racist, and like so many, he inherits his racism as a learned trait from his father.
The judge.
The judge. Now, if Finn inherits that racism, what was I thinking could make him get unhinged about his racism and take it on to the next level? And that thing, that unhinging factor for me, was that He had been brought up a racist, and he fell for a black woman. He was attracted to a black woman. So that's one of those unhinging things for Finn. Another angle that through which I got to the Black Mary was a question that almost nobody asked. I've never heard asked about Huckleberry Finn, which is what kind of a woman would have a child with Pap Finn?
He was so repulsive, so dangerous, so menacing.
Yes, and under what circumstances would a woman spend any time with him whatsoever? Mm. The answer in my mind and in this book is that it was a woman under duress, a woman held captive. Finn is a great imprisoner of people. You remember he imprisons Huck and Huckleberry Finn. Mm-hmm.
Huck finally kills a hog and then smears the blood everywhere to make it look like he's dead to get away.
Right. Which Finn doesn't buy at all in my reading of the book, by the way. Finn doesn't believe that.
He knows darn well what's going on here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he imprisons this. He steals a black woman and imprisons her. The third angle that pointed toward a black mother is sort of within Huck himself, his great familiarity with slave culture and slave superstition, his language and his mode of speech, which the great linguist Shelley Fisher Fishkin explained in her book called Was Huck Black, which is really about his mode of thinking more than about his skin color, but I took it to the next step.
But and this goes right to the heart of it. In Huck's, ultimately, Huckleberry Finn is important, famous, not for his relationship with Tom Sawyer, but with Jim, the slave.
Absolutely.
And in that relationship, Huck Finn so thoroughly plays, at least to my memory of my reading of Huckleberry Finn, he plays the role of the young white man who's trying to decide in that famous scene whether or not to rat Jim out or to let him go. And this is a struggle in the deep recesses of his soul, kind of the archetypal American struggle about race. He thinks he'll go to hell if he lets a slave go.
It is.
Finally says, all right then, I'll go to hell. And he tears up the letter that he was going to send back, to Miss Watson and says, I'll go to hell. But he seems to live all this as a white man looking at a black slave, not as a brother, not just under, but on the skin.
And when I think of that scene you're describing, fairly late in Huck Finn, my favorite line is when Huck tells himself, "You can't pray a lie." Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful statement, and it has to do with his discovering the truth of his relationship with this black man who he sees as a human being.
But doesn't he see himself as a white boy in that relationship?
Well, one of the secrets that's worked out in sort of a long series of Shakespearean changes of identity that happened throughout the last third or so of my novel. I had to make it very, very clear that Huck could exit my book, Finn, thinking himself a white boy with a white mother. In other words, I had to deprive him of his mother by the end of my novel. I'd rather not tell much more than that. But it was really crucial to me to leave him to act out the epiphany that Mark Twain gave him. I would deserve to be chastised if I didn't.
We'll take it that far down the river and no further right now. Sue's calling from Wenham, Massachusetts. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, John. I've spoken
to
you at some point this last summer. And
hey, welcome.
Wife, Wendy. I wanted to make a point about the book, which I've read. Many points, but I'll try to limit it to one thing. I loved this book. I just found it so engaging.
Thank you.
There's the way the words wrap around all the stuff that you're telling. Your language is incredible. But another thing that's really exciting for me was the sequencing of the plot. It flips back and forth between times, and it seemed to me, and I guess I can phrase this as a question, that at the beginning of the novel, the time switches were slower, and you stayed with one plot line longer.
Yes.
And as the book nears completion, they start happening faster and faster with fewer and fewer clues that all of a sudden you're in another time. At least that's the way it felt to me as I read this thing. And I kept trying to keep track of where I was and which storyline I was in, and I finally gave up. And when I gave up, I felt like I was supposed to do that and see it all as all the same.
So tumbling in the river.
Interesting.
John,
interesting.
Was it intentional, or were you getting attention deficit disorder as you wrote deeper into this book? Or
yeah,
did
I was
you
just
want
losing
the,
track.
Right.
I was drinking. I was drinking moonshine with right. Finn.
Or were you trying to get frantic? Or it's not linear. That's for sure.
It is nonlinear. There was a definite. That's a very true reading, Sue. The book does proceed. It does gather speed in terms of its time shifting as it goes along. Finn himself, as you can imagine, is intoxicated through a great amount of the book, and in some measure, the time shifting kind of reflects his wandering mind. It also reflects his interest in sort of conflating the past and the present. So as the book moves toward its conclusion, it moves through these sequences more and more and more rapidly. And to Finn, they're all sort of the same in a way, I think. Mm. But to the reader, they just kind of pick up momentum.
John Clinch, I want to bring another voice in, if I may. We spoke on this show, I don't know, sometime I think in the last year with Ron Powers, who wrote a big biography of Mark Twain. He's one of those who's not a fan of this reading. He says, this is not Mark Twain's Pat Finn. Well, I mean, you wrote the book, so then it wouldn't necessarily be. But we've got a Twain scholar with us right now from Claremont, California. We're joined by Laura Scandera Trombley. She's president of Pitzer College, a real dyed-in-the-wool Mark Twain scholar. You may have seen her in Ken Burns' 2002 documentary, Mark Twain. She's author of Constructing
Absolutely.
Mark Twain, Mark Twain in the Company of Women. She's got a new book coming out, Mark Twain's Other Woman. Laura Scandera Trombley, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So what
Hi,
you...
Laura.
Hi.
What do you make, oh great Twain scholar, of John Clinch's sacrilege here with Finn? Sacrilege or the right kind of magnification? You've read some of Finn. I don't know if you've finished yet. I know you were in the middle of it last night. What do you make of it?
I just think the world of it. I really enjoyed it, and I was very pleased that John, I think, has really embraced Pap's evilness. And I agree with the earlier caller who was contrasting his experience with the novel and the kind of Disneyfication that has taken place over the years with Pap. Pap truly is an extraordinarily evil character, and he has really been glossed over in popular productions, and I think John has provided a wonderful and extremely textured interpretation and backstory for Pap.
Washington
well,
Post.
That comes as a relief.
There you go. You've got one. You've got a green light here. Washington Post says.
And the dyed-in-the-wool Twain scholar.
There you go.
There you go. The Post said Mark Twain would have loved it, or worse to that effect. How we possibly project back, I have no idea. But what about the very idea of someone stepping in to his boatman's shoes, riding off of his work, standing on his shoulders? Would Twain have laughed? Would he have said, thank God John Clinch picked up the pen in hell? How do you think he might have responded, Laura?
Well, Twain, trying to read into this, would have been instantly competitive. But one of the things that Twain accomplishes so remarkably in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is he creates a story without end. And he deliberately puts in scene after scene that the reader then is forced to complete. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to create a novel where all of the questions are answered. He wants to leave the reader still trying to figure out just what is going on in this novel. And I think what John does is he brings a really important perspective to the character of Pap. So I think Twain would have done an extremely careful reading of the book, would have written in a great deal of marginalia, and in the end, I think he would have really enjoyed it.
And what about at the core of this, the core of Finn's boiling anger and agony, this black common law wife who he ultimately treats in the worst possible way, but along the way appears to love, and his half-black or black son, Huck? What do you make of that? What do you imagine Mark Twain would have made of it?
Well, Twain obviously discussed this theme in Pudd'nhead Wilson. Mm. So this mm-hmm. was not foreign to him.
When you say this theme, you mean the love-hate relationship?
No, the intermingling of the races mm-hmm. with Roxana, his character Roxana. Mm-hmm. So this is mm-hmm. this is not something that Twain didn't delve into. He really was interested in these issues of race and experimented with them in his writing. So I don't think that this is anything that Twain didn't try and address. What I see as a real difference in terms of Pap's background is John has placed Pap within a family that actually has social status and that has been in America for several generations.
Through the judge, the grandfather of Huck Finn, who's got standing, but with Huck Finn's father being the black sheep of the family, you've seen that sometimes otherwise.
Well, in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, obviously there isn't any kind of backstory for, mm-hmm. for just where Finn has come from. And I've always read that as Twain's commentary on Irish immigration and how the Irish were treated between 1820 and mm-hmm. say, the Civil War.
With Finn as the drunken, angry stereotype.
Finn is someone who has really been crushed by his surroundings and now has become part of the beast. And it places Finn in a very different context to view him as someone who has come from an established family and from wealth, who has fallen away from that. So you have two very different kinds of potential contexts for Finn's background.
John Clinch, is that the greatest liberty you've taken here?
I think it probably is, and I must tell you that it does my heart good to hear Laura calling this character Finn instead of Pap. Thank you. my giving him only that one name and not permitting him to be called by anything but Finn time and again was a willful act that seems to have been contagious.
Did you worry that you'd be hounded off the bookshelves by angry Twain scholars, you know, waving pens from hell at you?
I did a little bit. That was in the back of my mind. There were really two issues that I thought that people might take issue with. One was the depravity of the character of Finn. One was the fact, as you've pointed out, of the biracial Huck. And actually, one of the reviewers, a fellow who reviewed it for the Mark Twain Forum, concluded his essay with the idea that if we're bothered by a biracial Huck, we need to remember that there's nothing in Twain that forbids it and that the case in Finn makes it pretty credible, and that if we're troubled, we need to look into our own hearts and ask ourselves why. So I think that was exactly the answer, the reaction I was hoping for, and certainly not the one I feared.
Laura Scandera Trombley, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking this hour about a dark new take on Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, Huck Finn's father, or just Finn in the name of John Clinch's new novel that builds on Huckleberry Finn, goes behind the Twain story to give his imagined backstory on that very, very rough father. What do you think? If Huck Finn is black or biracial, does it undercut the racial breakthrough with Jim at the heart of Huckleberry Finn? And what would Mark Twain think about the audacity of our Mr. Clinch? Cam is calling from Stonington, Connecticut. Cam, you're on the air with John Clinch.
Hi, Tom, and thanks for having me.
Sure.
I think audacity is the right word. I think it's a very, very audacious effort that the author has made. I haven't read this book. Your story today was the first that I had heard of it, and I'm looking forward to getting a copy and reading it, because I think this is a story that, to really complete the story of Huck, you've got to know where he came from.
But it's dark. I've got to tell you, I don't know if it's David Lynch or Deliverance. I mean, there is rough going in here.
I would expect no less. I would expect no less, given how Huck described his character. Because
it's definitely Huck Finn for 2007.
Yeah, but that cross of nails in Pap's boot. You know, that's still, in our sort of goth era, that still resonates pretty well.
Yeah.
That reads dark.
That you know, Huck came from a bad place in terms of his father, and his father haunted him. He was in fear of his life.
Yeah, yes, he was.
Throughout the book, and you know, there's a scene of finding of in Huck Finn of the house floating down the river after the flood.
Right.
And Jim discovering that the man in the house was Pap, but not telling Huck.
Right. Right.
Until a long time later, when Huck makes a comment, he says, "You know," he said, "but I've still got to keep moving because I'm afraid of my father." And Huck finally says, "Well, you know, that man that was all covered up, I wouldn't let you look at, that was him."
Jim lets him know, and it gets even weirder in John Clinch's telling. Cam, thanks very much for that call. John, I want to look at that telling, but I wish you'd read a little bit where you introduce Huck. I mean, Finn, the father, plays a much bigger role in this story. Tom Sawyer barely shows up at all, kind of just glancingly, but you've got a lovely sort of introduction of Huck and the place where he sits there on page, just right at the beginning, 8 or so.
I have it. He is between worlds, this boy, between the river and the town, between the hogshead and the house, between the taint of his mother and the stain of his pap. He knows some things that he can never say, not even to himself. He has trained his companions well, these boys forbidden to associate with him on account of his mother's suspected stigma and his father's famed trouble with whiskey, these boys who associate with him nonetheless and perhaps all the more intently for being forbidden his company, although they do not generally encounter him at school or at church or at any of the other places ordinarily deemed suitable for boys of the village. They find his dark history as dizzying as a leap from some great bluff into a Mississippi pool, and his scrapes with his violent pap as thrilling as a narrow escape from Injun Joe's cave, and his deep, broad knowledge of woodsman's lore and slave superstition as enchanting as a spell of protection against night-walking spirits or werewolves, these boys forbidden to play with him yet drawn into his wake like needles to a lodestone, these boys whom he has trained well enough that at least one of them knows what he'll say before he says it, and indeed has said it already, that the body they have discovered is not a man's at all on account of it floats face up.
John Clinch reading from Finn, and there's Huck sleeping in that sugar hogshead giant barrel at the edge of the village and training the boys he plays with not to go there in some parts of his life, afraid maybe even to go there himself. I don't want to leave voiceless his blood mother is represented here, Mary, a stolen slave taken in by his father, Finn. What kind of character do you give her, and how does she respond? How does she stand up in this really what would seem the worst possible circumstance to have come to be the property of this man?
They are the worst possible circumstances. Mary is an individual who expects better out of life. She was brought up on a plantation, or at least by a slaveholder in the very, very deep South, an old woman named Mrs. Fisk, who has believed that the black race deserves better than it has gotten. She taught Mary, for example, how to read.
She's literate. Finn is not.
That's right. That makes Mary literate and Finn not. There's a moment in the novel when we see Mary reading to Finn poetry that he's found in a floating steamer trunk. So there's that. And she expects more from life. Mrs. Fisk had taught her that things might get better. Mary also expects better, therefore, out of white people than she gets from Finn.
Does she get anything but his brutality, the back of his hand? I mean, there is a relationship, at least in his mind, one that drives him crazy, one that leaves her dead. But what about her side of that?
There is a relationship, one that she tries to make the most of. We have to remember that here she is with an alternative, which is essentially to go over into Missouri and permit herself to be taken back into slavery, or to travel down south down the river and no doubt be returned to slavery, or to light out on her own, perhaps to the north, which is fear-inducing as well. So sort of the devil you know versus the devil you don't is how she ends up returning to Finn. But she also has Huck. She has the chance in being Huck's mother. They spend a whole year alone while Finn is in prison. She has a chance to raise him up, which is one of the high points of her life. And then giving him up later is probably the other.
Charlie's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom. How's it going?
Pretty good. What do you know? Hi, Charlie.
Well, here's one of the most interesting parts about this process is this. Painting, Tom, you used the term biracial. And we know historically, if you had one drop of black, quote-unquote, black blood,
yep,
you were considered black. So what really it cares, Tom, Huck Finn and the whole didactic there, and the whole light is you move into today's, the 21st century. You really got a whole different set of readers now and a whole different perspective on a classic.
So does it make you more or less interested if Huck is, you know, we have such a vocabulary out of history right up to black, mulatto, biracial. Does it draw you to the book or send you away, Charlie?
Well, what it does is I'm turned off the road and I'm heading toward Barnes & Noble.
All right. Good luck with it.
Go, Charlie, go.
Good luck with it. Yeah, Charlie, thanks for your call. You know, there's one, before we leave Mary, the mother here, there's a reading late in the book where part of what drives Finn to his ultimate big rampage is that he's been sort of ratted out in his relationship, long relationship with this woman, by a kind of a village half-wit.
Yes.
He takes his revenge on that chap with Mary at his side. And there's a strange kind of weird cross-race Bonnie and Clyde mad moment here. I wish you'd read for us.
This is one of my favorite scenes from the novel. The half-wit Tyrell lives across the way from Finn's father, the judge. Finn has been hiding Mary, both hiding and imprisoning her, in a shack behind the judge's barn. And as you say, the half-wit Tyrell has ratted him out. And Finn and Mary have been expelled like Adam and Eve. And Finn goes to speak with Tyrell. He sees him as he's leaving the premises, and he says to him, "Why'd you tell him?" "Why not?" says Tyrell, "for there is no other reason, or at least none better." Finn strides to the old man and takes the vegetal stalk of his neck in one hand and presses upon it. With the other, he knocks the pipe to the floor and covers the old man's mouth, lest he cry out. Through the window, he sees Mary waiting, and he presses harder, taking no pleasure in it, but hanging on to the old man as he would to a rattlesnake got likewise by the throat or some other dangerous beast desirous of doing him harm. When he is finished and Tyrell lies limp, he locates a jug of coal oil and empties it upon the half-wit and his threadbare couch, and scatters red embers from the corncob pipe thereon rather than waste matches. Under full dark, they crouch in the woods along the margin of the property, and together they watch as Tyrell's house burns to the ground. They have barely gotten themselves settled when the half-wit's wife hobbles shrieking from the front door in her nightgown, bereft of home and husband, and flings herself full upon some sympathetic neighbor. Finn has forgotten about her entirely, and he is taken aback to witness her standing there, big as life, solid as denunciation, describing, no doubt, the atrocity she discovered upon the parlor couch when she came down to call the old man to bed. Mary cherishes the inch or two of space between their crouched bodies, and she brushes away a tear with the back of her hand. But for their shining eyes, the lurking two of them are invisible in the dark woods, she in particular, despite the light cast round about by flames. At the height of the blaze, Finn bumps against her and takes her forearm in his hand and speaks, without turning away from this bright thing he has created. His voice comes to her amid the crackle of fire and the crash of falling beams and the roar of wind through flame, as if from the throat of some reassuring demon. "I'd done this for you."
"I'd done this for you," says Finn to his black common-law wife as he burns the home and kills the man who exposed their relationship, but the next one doomed is her. Bobby's calling from Winooski, Vermont. Bobby, you're on the air.
Yeah, Winooski.
Winooski, excuse me.
Yeah, I don't mind. listen, this is an argument I've been having for some time. I used to be an English teacher. I never taught that book, but I contend that during the big heat in the late 60s, early 70s, when people were, I don't like to say that word, you know, using the N-word and calling on Twain, I felt that Twain, given his progressive attitudes, he had very progressive attitudes on a lot of things, not just race, he welcomed Russian revolutionaries to New York. Given that, I believe that he would have at least let people make end dash. And I guess there was no way to remove the word. But that's what I believe. And
You mean it's all over? It is all over Twain's work, this work in particular. But he wouldn't have used it today. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I'm saying that if he were alive today, mm-hmm. he would say, "Okay, you can do that."
Because I think that's an interesting point.
But n dash is very different than the full on n word.
Yes, that's true. But I think he was obviously a caring, wonderful person. You know, why wouldn't he have done that?
Well, frankly, in speaking to that in terms of my novel, the narrator in this book definitely uses the word black anytime he refers to a black person, unless he's sort of in the brain of Finn or one of the other characters. So I think
that's
I've
the
kind
narrator,
of
but
acted
you're unsparing in using the N word all over the place elsewhere, as Twain did. It's hardly absent.
The characters use it. Yeah.
So what does that mean? I'm curious about that as well. That word is so much in the air these days. We had Russell Simmons, the hip-hop, you know, entrepreneur, on last week. He's got it, aplenty. Is it a sign, in your view, you've got plenty of it in here, though not in the narrator's mouth, but is it a sign that we're moving somewhere? Is it being reborn in some deeper historical understanding? Is there a usage that takes, that has accountability built into it, or is it still the epithet? Period.
You know, my usage here is strictly as an historical artifact. The narrator is outside time. The characters are in the time of 1840, 1842, and they say it, and that's documented, and it's an historical document in a sense. As for other uses of it, I mean, my response is that I think Chris Rock said it best, that white people aren't allowed to use the N-word because we haven't used it properly in the past.
And what about Finn finally and that cross you hang him on where he's in love with a woman of the race that he's been raised to despise? Where do you point for the rest of America there? Is that something central to the American experience now, then? Is that part of it?
It definitely is. And this book is about two things. It's about race and it's about fathers and sons. The racial issues are things that I think we... It's also about violence, but some of those things are issues that we don't talk about and think about enough, and we think we've forgotten about, and we think we've solved. And I don't believe that we have. I think when I was writing this book, actually my niece, I think, when I was doing it, was in the process of getting married to a black man. So I was, I think I was sort of psychologically set up for thinking about these things.
And when you think of young Huck himself, leave that father aside for a minute, with all of his volatility and violence. But what about Huck? Does it leave you emotionally closer to Huck? Are you more sympathetic? Put yourself back, you know, as the boy under the covers reading the book. Are you closer to Huck Finn after exploring his father in your imagination this deeply?
To me, I think I know that I am, and basically that's because my original read and my abiding read of Mark Twain's novel was that Huck Finn existed in a world that cared nothing for him. He mattered not to the adults around him. And in this novel, he certainly once again matters not by the end of this novel. He has been, or at least he has been sprung from everyone who cares about him, and it's sort of set on that path. And that makes me feel a little closer to that character, although he's not the central character here.
And that moment at standing at the bar where his father says, as I recall for a minute, I should have sold.
He's lucky I didn't sell him long ago,
I think
he says.
My God. And the grandfather who advises, maybe you should just track him down and shoot him, clean up the family line. This is rough stuff. We're going to go out with Tom Waits. You've imagined him for a role if this ever goes to the screen.
Yes, I have.
And it could be. Where would you put Tom Waits in this story? I guess we'll go out instrumentally here. But yeah.
There's a blind bootlegger named Bliss who is... Sort of Finn's pusher in many ways. He also is familiar with Finn's father. And, I think he's Tom Waits all over.
Are you going to the big screen? Did I read that? Is Hollywood sniffing you?
There is interest. There is interest. So a good bit of interest, which I think is fascinating. And, of course, the writer's the low man on that particular totem pole.
Right.
But we'll see what happens.
And this would not be Disney, a version of Huckleberry Finn. John Clinch, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for the new book, Finn. That's a work of imagination that we'll dip into. Again, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Finn is the book, a whole new take on Huck Finn's dad. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.